Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
I'd like to welcome everybody to the Parsha class for Vayishlach, 5766. Parshas Vayishlach, I always have that tingly feeling that it's almost Hanukkah. And I would like to share with you today a very, very central theme, very central, not only in the Chumash, but in life itself. And it's a theme which I must say, it's not talked about a lot, at least in my experience, in the traditional yeshiva discussion. It's a topic which, whatever exposure and whatever association I have with it, I believe comes through the Weinberg family. And after we talk about it, I will explain why that's true. When I say the Weinberg family, primarily refer to my Rebbe, the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Yaakov Weinberg Zatzal, who not only discussed the topic, but he taught the topic in real life, in his way of life, in his way of teaching. And I also refer to his son, who I do not really know personally. He doesn't live here. He lives in Eretz Yisrael, Rav Matisyahu Weinberg Shlita, who wrote some years ago, maybe 20 years ago, a book called Patterns in Time. His first book was Volume 8, because it was on the holiday of Hanukkah, and I believe he wanted to publish a book on each of the holidays, Hanukkah being the last one, and so he started with Volume 8. This is a book which is not a standard book. It's written with a lot of small explanations, a lot of sources, some of them from Zohar. It's all in English, but some of the writers that wrote letters of approbation say that he has revealed secrets of Torah, which is kind of sensitive. Some people have even said that this book is controversial because it reveals sensitive information. But it's something which is unique. I would like to try to give over the flavor of the conversation because I think that it is something central to Judaism, and it's something that, as I said, we may not hear about this discussion. I think if you live in this community, you will relate to it much more readily and much more naturally than in some other communities, because this community has been influenced by the Weinberg family in many ways. And I hope that we will clarify all the issues, but at least give a clear flavor for what the issues are. The major issue is about Olam Haba and Olam Hazeh. The other world, Olam Haba, that's talked about a lot. But Olam Hazeh, this world, is not talked about that much. The Jewish approach to Olam Hazeh, to this world. I'm going to start by sharing with you a question, a simple question, a casual question that my father and I discussed last week. He raised the question and we followed up more on it at the Shabbos table. He said that he never understood why the Torah emphasizes that Avraham and Yitzchak and Yaakov were so wealthy, because he never associated wealth as being an important value. And I acknowledge the question. I acknowledge that, yeah, in general, we do not place a lot of emphasis and value on being wealthy. When somebody who's Jewish, especially if he's religious, is wealthy, it's kind of like an enigma or some type of an aberration or deviation. You mean he's wealthy and religious? And so I appreciate where he's coming from. But the fact of the matter is, the Torah does emphasize that Abraham was wealthy and Yitzchak was wealthy, and many other things about them, which we don't associate with religious people. They were influential, they were powerful, they were respected by all world powers, or hated, whatever the case may be. And I also backed it up by saying that, look at Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon. We're learning in our Navi class about the Book of Kings. He was the wealthiest and the most charismatic, and he was idolized by everyone the world over. So it's not inconsistent, but how is it not inconsistent with the values of righteousness and the values of humility and being satisfied with little, self-sacrifice? We're not really living for this world anyway. This is just a hallway to the world to come. And so this is a sensitive issue, but it's really a basic question, because we are here in this world. God created this world for a purpose. So what exactly is our relationship and our attitude towards Olam Hazeh? this world. So I kind of answered my father in a kind of a knee-jerk reaction in a simple way, and just to say that maybe what we have is a galus mentality. We have the mentality of being an exile where we're downtrodden and we're not held in high esteem, and therefore Jews have been wanderers and have been suffering and have been persecuted and have lived through poverty. I guess we're so used to that that we forget that once upon a time Jews used to be wealthy and powerful. That's what I said to my father. We're asking this question because of our exile mentality. But thinking about everything, as I'm trying this year to just integrate all of the various ideas and sources that we've learned, many in this class and things that I've heard from my teachers, I see that this is really just the tip of an iceberg. A really, really central question. And according to Rav Matthias Weinberg, it is the central issue of the saga of Parshas Toldos, Vayetze, Vayishlach, and beyond. So I'm going to try to give somewhat of a streamline of events and interpretations, many of which really come to a focal point in Vayishlach. I'd just like to recall that when we started this year off and we learned Parshas Bereishis, there was the observation that when God created the world, Olam Hazeh, this world, everything was Tov, Ki Tov, everything was good. The sky and the sea, the land, the celestial bodies, the grass, the fruits, the vegetation, the animals, man, everything was good. And good means godlike, connected with the divine. By living in this world, you were experiencing God. You could almost say that there was no distinction between physical and spiritual. It was totally synthesized. But as a result of the sin, things started to split apart. The immediate result of the sin was that Adam ingested some type of a self-centered spirit, something which made him feel separate from God, embarrassed about his nakedness. Man became capable of being jealous of another person. As we read the spiraling downward of the civilization, people started to become greedy and selfish and violent. Thus, there was all of a sudden a split between spirituality and possession of this world. And that's the basic problem, if you will, of civilization. And we had these individuals like Avraham and Yitzchak, who, with the power of will and absolute honesty and soul-searching, they discovered that there's really a God in the world, spirituality is real, and they developed a special relationship with God. And they kind of like restored things to the original balance. But they were just individuals. Try as they might, they would not be able to convert the world back to perfection. But Hashem wanted to invest in them and in their children to create at least this one nation that would be able to live by the ideals of Torah and spirituality and connection with God. Now Abraham and Yitzchak, as individuals, they synthesized the physical and the spiritual. And therefore they were wealthy. They were blessed with both worlds. Now, Yitzchak had an interesting dilemma. I'm going back now to Parshas Toldos, which we didn't really discuss at that time. He had two sons. And one son was clearly on a spiritual path, and one son was clearly on a physical path, Yaakov and Esau. And the basic problem is, how do we get back to synthesizing the spiritual and the material? So there were actually two different approaches to this problem with the two boys, Yaakov and Esau. There was Yitzchak's approach. His approach was, let's give worldly blessings to Esau. Let me bless him with what turned out to be Yaakov's blessing, but Yitzchak's intended blessing for Esau was the blessing of the material world. V'yitain lecha ha'elokim. I'm reading from Parshas Toldos, chapter 27, verse 28. V'yitain lecha ha'elokim mital ha'shamayim v'mishmanei ha'aretz v'rov dagon v'sirosh. And may God give you of the dew of the heavens and of the fatness of the earth an abundant grain and wine. So that's wealth. Yavducha amim v'yishtachavu lecha le'umim hevei gevir li'achecha v'yishtachavu lecha b'nei imecha orarecha orur u'mevarachecha baruch. Peoples will serve you, regimes will prostrate themselves to you, be a lord to your kinsmen, and your mother's sons will prostrate themselves to you. Cursed be they who curse you, and blessed be they who bless you. In other words, political success, strength, power, rulership. rule the world. These are the blessings that Yitzchak had intended to give to Esav. Blessings of Olam Hazeh, this world. Success, wealth. And what was his thinking? Why would he want to empower Esav to such an extent? Esav is not a spiritual creature. Does he want to empower somebody who is totally anti-God? No. Yitzchak envisioned a partnership between Yaakov and Esav, giving Esav the greatest possible credit that Esav would somehow use his material blessing to be an advocate and a supporter of Yaakov. This is a concept which is well established. It has been employed, but not between these two brothers. But that was Yitzchak's vision. Rivka had a different vision based on the reality that she had, which was that Esav is so anti-spiritual, so anti-God, not only will he not pursue spirituality for himself, but he won't even give a dime to Yaakov to support him. On the contrary, he would thwart Yaakov, he would hound Yaakov, he would try to kill Yaakov. Therefore, Rivka said, there is a lot out there in this world, Olam Hazeh. Don't give it to Esav, you have to give it to Yaakov. In other words, Yaakov has to possess the key to both worlds. Yaakov has to be the spiritual leader and the leader in physical matters. Yaakov has to become wealthy, just as you were, Yitzchak, although she wasn't talking to him. Yaakov has to be wealthy, Yaakov has to be powerful. Yaakov has to subjugate Esav. So Rivka had her way. She was right. So Yaakov is now blessed with both worlds. He's not used to it. He's used to being an Ishtam Yoshev Ohalim. He's used to sitting in the tents and only having to focus on the spiritual realm, because he's under the wing of Yitzchak. Yitzchak can take care of whatever public relations or any political issues that have to be made. Yitzchak did that. Avraham did that. Yaakov never did that. So not only did Rivka arrange for Yaakov to receive the blessing, but she also set out to put him on a training course. How to possess the blessings of this world. And believe it or not, the 20 years that we read about last week that Yaakov spent living with Lavan was that training course. In Lavan's domain, Yaakov learned how to be involved in a business deal. He learned how to be deceptive with people who deceive you without being dishonest. Yaakov learned how to remain truthful in an untruthful environment. Yaakov learned how to become wealthy. Yaakov learned how to employ cunning and cleverness in gaining that wealth. Again, in a way that's totally above board. So Yaakov learned in 20 years how to manage his blessings. So we have basically two prototypes which have a different relationship with Olam Hazeh. By the way, I didn't mention, but Esav was also blessed. In Parshas told us when he came back from hunting, he found out that his father had given the blessing to Yaakov. He begged his father for a blessing, and his father did oblige, although originally reluctant. So Yitzchak, his father, answered and said to him, "Behold, of the fatness of the earth shall be your dwelling, and of the dew of the heavens from above. By your sword you shall live, but your brother you shall serve. Yet it shall be that when you are aggrieved, you may cast off his yoke from upon your neck." So Yitzchak was telling Esav, I'm blessing you with wealth too. You are also going to possess the blessing of this world, but you're going to have to work it out with Yaakov as to who has the upper hand. And I'll tell you that it's not going to be both of you. It's either going to be him or it's going to be you. So again, we have two different people who have the key to the blessing of Olam Hazeh, of this world. It's a very, very interesting dichotomy. You've got Esav, who has the key to Olam Hazeh, but that's it, only one key. You have Yaakov, who has two keys. He has a key to Olam Hazeh and a key to Olam Haba. And there's a lot of differences between an Olam Hazeh which accompanies Olam Haba, material which is in consonance with the spiritual, and material which is only unto itself. And now we will get into some of the differences by looking at Yaakov and looking at Esav in Parshas Vayishlach. Rabbi Miller spoke this past Wednesday on Yaakov and Esav. Rabbi Miller, by the way, is a student of Rav Matis Weinberg, and therefore he also teaches of this theme, he pointed out some differences between Yaakov and Esav and their relationship to materialism. I don't mean materialism as a bad thing, I mean physical possession. Yaakov arrives home, back to Eretz Yisrael, after the 20 years living with Lavan, and he is anticipating an encounter with Esav. And the first thing we know is that he sends Esav a gift of many animals, because Yaakov is loaded right now. And he says to Esav, through his messenger, Ko somrun ladoni le'Esav, so shall you say to my master Esav, Ko amar avdecha Yaakov, so says your servant Yaakov, Im Lavan garti, I sojourned with Lavan, vo'echar ad ata, and I tarried there until now, I have lingered there. And there I have acquired shor v'chamor, tzon v'eved v'shivcha, all of this wealth. So Rabbi Miller stopped on the word vo'echar, and I lingered, I tarried, as if to say that underscores a very big difference between Yaakov's approach to Olam Hazeh and Esav's. Yaakov acquires wealth through lingering, through a long process of hard work, honest, hard work. I lingered, I worked year after year after year without being deceptive, without compromising truth. Even when I was deceived, I continued to work hard and honestly, and this is why I have gained wealth. Now, I am going to give you, he says to Esav, this gift is huvaslach. It is brought to you. Huvaslach. This gift is brought to you. I have brought this gift to you. Rabbi Miller says this underscores the difference between Yaakov's approach and Esav's approach to this world. Yaakov is willing to work long and hard to acquire possessions, whereas Esav's approach is huvaslach, bring it all to me at once. Or as Rabbi Miller said, the fast food mentality. I want it now. I want it preferably without any effort. Just give me. This is a big difference between one approach and the other. Honesty versus dishonesty in the business world is another difference. Lavan is also a character which represents this world, but he lives by deceit. So we have truth versus falsehood. We have hard work versus immediate gratification. And also the famous difference. First, Esav says, oh, I don't need this gift. Yesh li rav, I have much. And Yaakov says, yesh li kol, I have everything. What's the difference? I have much. I have a lot. That's greed. Look how much I have. Yaakov says, I have all that I need. So that's another big difference. One is, I'm grateful. As the sages say, who is wealthy? He who is happy with his lot. Gratitude, a feeling of satisfaction, versus, I have a lot, but boy, would I like a lot more. This insatiable desire for possessions. So, as these two brothers meet, we really get to hear, through subtleties of their language, a whole different approach to Olam Hazeh. But anyway, we go back to the original question, which is, so how did it turn out in the end? Did Yaakov end up hanging on to the blessing and being on top, where this world would be, so to speak, controlled and ruled by a spiritual person? Or did Esav end up being the strong one, and the control of this world would be filtered down through the eyes and through the perspective of a complete material person? In other words, Yaakov and Esav, this millennia-long battle, says Rav Matthias Weinberg, is the battle between the sovereignty over Olam Hazeh. Is Olam Hazeh, is this world, controlled by the spiritual ones or by the non-spiritual ones? So, in one respect, it seems that Yaakov came back, he was on top. He comes back to Esav, he's not afraid to face him. He basically tells Esav, listen, I became wealthy, that means the blessing that our father gave to me has been fulfilled. And Esav kind of gives up the fight. He doesn't kill him. In fact, Esav actually makes a proposition to Yaakov in chapter 33, that's where it says the Rav and the Kol. But in chapter 33, verse 12, Esav says to Yaakov, Vayomer, Nisa b'nei lecha, v'yelcha l'negdecha. He says, let us go. I will proceed alongside you. Esav makes a proposition to Yaakov. He says, you know what? Maybe we should try that partnership after all, the way that Yitzchak had envisioned it. I see that I can't push you over. I see that you are a new person now. You are no longer just the man of the tent, but you have synthesized Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba. I can't really defeat you. So let's be partners. Yaakov, however, resists. And Yaakov says, Adoni yodea ki hayeladim rakim, v'yatzon v'abakar alos alai. He says, my Lord knows, he tries to push him off, that the children are tender, the nursing flocks and cattle are upon me. If they will be driven hard for a single day, then all the flocks will die. Let my Lord go ahead of his servant. I will make my way at my slow pace, according to the gate of the drove before me, and the gate of the children, until I come to my Lord at Seir. You go on to Seir. That's your heritage, the beautiful, fertile land which Esav wanted for his portion that Yaakov had given him. That's the seat of the beautiful, rich, fertile material life. And Yaakov says, I'll get there, but I'll get there at a later time. Go on ahead without me. What's the significance of him saying, go on ahead without me? On one hand, he resisted Esav's proposal at being partners because he knew that you can't make a partnership with somebody who is so anti-spiritual as Esav. But what was the intimation of saying, I'll get there later? Also, let's recall that there was another incident in the Parsha. Before Yaakov actually encounters Esav, he wrestles with a man. And this man, say our sages, is the archangel of Esav. And they have this battle. And according to our theme, this is a battle between who is going to control this world. Is it going to be Yaakov and his newfound synthesis of physicality with spirituality? Or is it going to be Esav, the completely physical being? Who wins by the time of the morning? Yaakov. Yay! Yaakov's on top. But not without an injury. Plus, we find something that Yaakov is criticized for, that as he addresses Esav, both at the beginning of their encounter and when he says, pass on ahead, he says, Yavor no Adoni lifnei avdo. Let my Lord go ahead of his servant. He submits himself to Esav. So, who won? Who's on top? It's not a clear answer. Yaakov won, but not without a casualty. Yaakov took the lead, but not without some submission to Esav. Now, I'm going to read a few paragraphs of Rav Matthias Weinberg's book and show how this all has great significance in our world, because we have to ask ourselves the same question. Who's running the world? Are we going to live with the gullus mentality of my Lord and the basic conscience that we have that the Jew is really on the bottom? If a Jew happens to be wealthy, that's some type of an accident, of an aberration. Really, the people that run the world are the Esavs, the creators of modern civilization, of Western civilization. They control the media. They control public opinion. It is their anti-spiritual approach to the world that really permeates the thinking of the world, ourselves included. We're just kind of schleppers who try to keep whatever semblance of our tradition we have, but we're not players. Is that the truth? Did Esav really end up on top, at least for now? Or what happened to Yaakov? What happened to his promise? So I'm going to read to you several paragraphs which will really tie everything together. Chapter 10.3, A World Lost. Thus shall you speak to my master Esav. Your servant Yaakov says, Bereishis 32.5. At that moment, when Yaakov called Esav my master, this is a quote from Bereishis Rabbah, from the Midrash. The Holy One said to him, you debased yourself and called Esav master 8 times. By your life, I will bring from his children 8 kings before your own children are kings. And here's Rabbi Weinberg. Yaakov Avinu invested 20 years of hard labor preparing to meet Esav and succeeded at last in besting Lavan and defeating the Tsar, the angel of Edom. Those two achievements are carefully alluded to in the message sent by Yaakov to Esav as their first face-to-face meeting approaches. But, at the very last minute, instead of standing his ground, Yaakov appears to grovel before Esav, betraying all his own accomplishments. Quoting the Zohar, when Esav heard this, he thought, I'll never defeat him. It's best I make peace with him. See, Esav perceived that Yaakov had gained strength. But then Yaakov started to bow and scrape in front of him. So Esav thought, why is he bowing to me? Why is he calling me master? If he really had all this power, he wouldn't be bowing to me. Says Rabbi Weinberg again, the issue of this meeting was not simply whether Yaakov would be sending gifts to Esav or confronting him from a position of strength. What Yaakov did here was to have drastic implications for all the rest of history. For Yaakov actually gave away the entire world to Esav, bringing us thousands of years of suffering, committing Yisrael to a secondary position, and leaving Western civilization as the primary power and developer of the world. Please pass ahead, my master. Quoting the Zohar again, Yaakov said, let Esav have his rule now. I will suffer your gullus until the time comes for me to rule over the mountain of Esav. I'm happy taking a back seat for now and being on top later. We live the lives we do in a world which believes that ethics, morality, and all the grandeur destined for mankind belong to the worldview which is Esav's because of these five words of Yaakov. In other words, we gave the world to Esav. Olam hazeh, Yaakov said, you can have it for now. The Holy One said, by your life, Yaakov, it will be just as you said. Esav will rule over you in this world. We live the frustration, continues Rabbi Weinberg, of seeing Torah and truth consigned to a corner, a poor and bedraggled stepchild, because Yaakov felt he still needed time. The promised meeting to settle accounts in Seir has been delayed over 3,500 years. Something snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. There was still one handicap in Yaakov, the complete man. Then he goes on to describe, backtracking to the wrestling match, and how Yaakov won, but was injured. And he utilizes another more famous statement from the Zohar about this. The damage done to Yaakov during the struggle with Esav was significant enough to result in a permanent prohibition. Until today, we do not eat the hindquarters of the animal unless the entire sciatic nerve is removed. This was the only damage the Tsar could inflict upon Yaakov. And now from the Zohar. Esav found Yaakov complete and whole in everything. What could he do? He cleverly decided to damage his thigh. What does the thigh represent? His support. The thigh is what you stand on. He said, in removing support for the Torah, the voice of Yaakov will become weaker, and the hands of Esav will become stronger. Now that there are none to support those who study Torah, they won't have a thigh or a leg to stand on. Says Rabbi Weinberg, Yaakov was damaged in his ability to utilize money. The leg to stand on as a symbol for independence and wealth is found in the Torah in reference to Korach, man's money which stands him on his feet, Pesachim. Yaakov limped away from the encounter, damaged in his ability to mobilize the resources of this world meaningfully. To this very day, the financial success of an enterprise is in strikingly inverse proportion to its significance for Torah. I.e., the people that really have the money in the world are not supporting Torah. This is the insidious penetration Esav achieved into Yisrael. And through it, our relationship to the world and its development has been crippled. No longer can we bend the world's production in the direction of meaning. The Gira Nasha opened the way to the breakdown in the kingdom of Israel, to schism. The damage left Yaakov open, de facto, to the partnership Esav so desired. To avoid that danger, Yaakov was willing to suffer the devastating loss of a world to Esav. In other words, when Esav said, be my partner, and he says no, he pushed him away and he conceded too much. He said, okay, you have the whole world, I'll just keep this. Almost to say, I'll go back to the tent. And so, Yaakov is strong, but he's limping. There will be a point in time where the limping will be healed. The Torah goes on to say that when Yaakov continued on in his journey, he came to Shechem, and he was shalem, he was complete. He had been healed from the limp. Rabbi Weinberg says that that indicates that there will be a time in history when we will be back on top again. But that's only going to be with the coming of the Mashiach. So to sum it all up, the question of who's wealthy is really the question of the history of the world. The blessing as it was given to Yaakov included the material blessing as well as the spiritual. Yaakov has the potential, had and has, the Jewish people have the potential to be on top of the world, literally, to subjugate any other power. But there has been somewhat of a hesitancy, somewhat of a intimidation that Esav has placed upon us that has kept us from fully claiming that which is ours. And therefore, we are suffering this gullus. Now, I'm not saying that everybody should go out there and start investing and getting rich quick and changing the world. I don't know how we do this in a practical way, but we have to realize that in some measure, we have to realize who we are. We have to realize what the intention of the world is to be. And when we talk about the coming of the Mashiach, we're talking about a world in which the balance has been righted and Israel is in control of both keys. But I want to end off with this thought. I mentioned that this is something that our Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Weinberg Zatzal, taught and lived. He was someone that talked about this. In other words, he did not just live in the tent. He made it a point to develop himself and develop his students so that at the very least, we could go out in the world and we could talk to people in the streets, so to speak, of the civilization in which we are still backseaters. But we can talk about with our brethren who we are and who we're supposed to be. We can make them feel that they are part of the winning team and that this is only a temporary condition. They don't have to live their lives living under the shadow of an Esav. They can live their lives as proud followers of Yaakov and members of the Jewish nation, which is really the winning team. Rav Weinberg believed in developing oneself, developing one's abilities, one's talents. When Rav Weinberg passed away, there was a gathering of students for a Shabbaton, and one of the students got up and he said that there are different approaches, different attitudes that observant religious Jews had about this question of Olam Haba and Olam Hazeh, this world and the other world, spirituality versus materialism. There are those that say, yes, there are two worlds. Yes, there's a spiritual world and there's a material world, but we can participate in both. We can be involved in the spiritual world and we can be involved in the physical world. There are those that said, yes, there are two worlds and we ought to just concern ourselves with the spiritual and not in the physical, which is, according to this theme, maybe like saying, let Esav have that. Let him have control. That's not for us. But that was not Rav Weinberg's attitude. What's the third alternative? He's not talking about saying we only want the physical world, not the spiritual world. That's Esav himself. The third alternative is if Yaakov truly synthesizes Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba, there's really only one world. There's really only one key. It's not separate. Olam Hazeh is not separate from Olam Haba. That's an Esav mentality. The whole chiddush, the whole novelty of Yaakov's approach is that the whole world is tov. It requires, obviously, tremendous rooting in the spiritual teachings to know how to follow the goodness and not how to follow the evil path, certainly. And it's a much bigger challenge, and it's much harder to say there's only one world than to say, let's just take the spiritual world and leave the material world out of it. It's much easier, simpler. Just stay in the tent. But to really live the Yaakov world requires a total synthesis such that it is only one world. The truth of the matter is that a major seminal figure that maybe started the process of healing the limp was Yosef HaTzadik. Yosef being a worldly leader while he was HaTzadik, while he was a tremendously spiritual, righteous person. This is the beginning of the next parsha. And at the beginning of the Hanukkah story, the whole book is about Hanukkah. So what does Hanukkah have to do with Yosef? That's the subject of this book. But the way Yosef took control of the world and was a tzaddik, he's a seminal figure in this healing. And indeed, there is a Rashi that quotes from the Chazal that Yaakov recognized this. It was only after Yosef was born that Yaakov says, now I can go face Esav. Somehow Yosef, this character who is both beautiful, physically powerful and charismatic, and is able to take control of a whole society, the most powerful society, like becoming the president of the United States, so to speak, and to be Yosef HaTzadik, and to maintain his integrity as a son of Yaakov, this is a seminal figure. And indeed, there is the concept of the Mashiach ben Yosef, that first a descendant of Yosef has to come and has to pave the way for the Mashiach ben David. I know I mentioned a lot of information here, and I don't think everything is so clear, but I hope that I've given over a flavor. This is an issue that is not always discussed. Why? Because it goes out of the tent thinking. It goes out of the realm of just all we need is the spiritual, all we need is to be in our own corner. Leave us alone. You guys can have the world. We'll just stay in our tent. It ventures out into the wide world of Olam Hazeh, which is fraught with dangers if you're not fully in control of this heritage. But that's why we don't venture there all the time. But we definitely learn from Rav Yaakov Weinberg Zatzal, and this is something that he did pass on, although it was not always popular, and although he was also perhaps called controversial, just as this book was called controversial. But thank God, we merited to get this flavor, at least just to start thinking about who really we are, who Yaakov is, and who Yisrael, the one that fully vanquishes Esav, is and will be in the future. And hopefully we can start to participate in that healing process in which we truly gain the sovereignty of Yisrael. Thank you.
The Rothschilds, how many people do they save over the, with their financial interest?
Good point. We do have to recognize the presence of those noble Jews, where God has literally blessed them and empowered them with tremendous influence and wealth. Baruch Hashem, we see it. We still think of it as the exception. We don't think that's the way it should be. Because look around, exactly like the Zohar says, when it comes to support, when it comes to Jewish education and institutions, we're always struggling. What they're saying is we gave away the key to Esau.
Only the Orthodox are suffering.
Right, because we have a problem with synthesizing the spiritual with the physical. We have a problem. We seem to think like it's either one or the other. And if you want to be wealthy, you have to let go of the spiritual path. And if you want the spiritual path, you have to be poor.
When Brooklyn, my brothers in Borough Park have a lot of different groups, and among the Hasidim, I'm not sure where all the money comes from, but they build beautiful big shuls, and they have communities, and there's a lot of money, and sometimes I see what they're doing fundraising-wise and all that. And I said, my God, where do all of this money come from? I see these beautiful books that they put out. For mega, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And they say because they're from and they do tithe and all that, there's a lot of money moving. And they're supporting the ones that cannot. They're helping those that can pay the tuition, keep the yeshivas in business, and keep the and some of those shoes are really magnificent. There.
Yeah. Again, let me give credit. In other words, maybe Baruch Hashem, we're starting. We saw the return of the Jews to Israel, and we see the flourishing of Torah and Torah institutions. It's a novel idea. In other words, the Golus experience over the 2,000 years that we've been under the Golus of Edom, which is Esav, we have been always the bedraggled ones. We've been schlepping along. It should be a sign of the redemption coming. Halavai, that should be it, and that we should continue and have this attitude. I think you wanted to say something.
To this point, when Yaakov left, went to Shem and Eber, he said 6 years, 8 years, that was supposed to allow him to survive Levant.
Right.
He comes back from Levant, supposedly, therefore, he should have spiritual, and he's supposed to be able to have a material life.
Right.
He had trouble synthesizing at that point. He was supposedly ready to handle Esav at that point.
Right, right, right. And he did. He did, but a little bit imperfectly.
Right, there's something lacking in what he learned from Levant, possibly, or what he got from...
Maybe it was a lack of confidence.
We never get into the personalities of these people, so you never know whether there's a lacking in the personality.
Right. Well, we just all we know, what we really know from the Torah, from the Chazal, is that he called Esav Adoni, my master. And Chazal said that was a bad move. In other words, he must have felt somehow a little bit intimidated, or somehow that he has to play up to Esav.
He still feels guilty that he took the birthright away from Esav, and he doesn't feel comfortable with that.
Whatever it is, we're not fully ready to. In Israel, we're still in Golis. We're not fully ready to claim that which is ours, which is really the entire world.
First of all, he knows, Yaakov sees that however he feels himself, he knows that Esav hasn't forgiven him when he sees 400 generals with 400 soldiers each.
Yes.
You know, he has a definite idea that this guy's not his buddy.
Yeah, but Esav didn't kill him. And Esav even said, let us travel together.
Before that.
Oh, before that.
Yeah, because that's why what I wanted to say was he bows down 7 times. To show Esav again that he's a man who lives in 7 days of the week. He's a man who lives in Torah. And he sets the stage for, we're going to be subservient to you. We that live in the world of God and earth, you know, spiritual and physical, we are subservient to you, which was the mistake that you're talking about, the Galut mentality.
Right.
But he has a son, Yosef, that doesn't bow.
Right.
And he is the beginning of our hope to one day say, here's one who stands.
Right.
And that's when Yaakov appears. But he's subservient, whether he's afraid or however, and he even says, we're not going to come to Seir because we're going at such a slow pace.
Right.
Jewish people aren't ready for Mashiach. We're not ready to take those reins.
Right.
Got to one day get to where we can stand like Yosef.
Right. Now, the truth is, it does happen to Yaakov because he gets to Shechem, and I didn't talk a lot about that. There's a lot of talk about that in the book. But Yaakov himself experiences that healing. But the interim way that he bowed already flawed the Jewish people for many, many years to come. And whatever Yosef did will again set the stage. He'll be able to influence the future time, but it's still delayed. But Yosef is a seminal figure in terms of the picture of the ultimate redemption. Yeah.
I have a question here. It does say that Joseph and Rachel came forward and bowed down.
You mean, why did Yosef, of all people, Yosef shouldn't have been one to bow?
It says here. Now, maybe in the Hebrew, maybe it says something different in the Hebrew, but it says, and afterwards, Joseph and Rachel came forward and bowed down. Binyamin is the one who didn't bow down because he wasn't born yet.
Well, Yosef hasn't really risen to his position. That happens in the next parsha.
Shaul, I think, and Mordechai.
From Binyamin. They didn't bow.
They didn't bow.
Right. I'm sorry, made a mistake.
Right, Binyamin.
Binyamin is
right.
the one that didn't bow down,
yes.
And he wasn't born yet. So there's the one that we have to hope with.
And the Beit Hamikdash is in the portion of Binyamin. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Okay.